Before we start the show, I'd like to talk to you about Brandwatch, which is a digital consumer intelligence company. It helps businesses better understand their consumers and buyers with clever software that enables them to analyze conversations from across the web and social media. To find out more, visit brandwatch.com and you can sign up for up-to-the-minute consumer insights in your inbox each week at brandwatch.com/bulletin. And it's worth mentioning that my business, Automated Creative, uses Brandwatch every single day, and our business would be impossible to deliver without it. So it's of real pride that I welcome them as partners for this week's episode. Hello and welcome to the Shiny New Object Podcast. My name is Tom Ollison. I'm the founder of Automated Creative, and this is a podcast about the future of marketing. Every week or so, I have the pleasure and privilege of interviewing one of our industry's leaders, and this week is no different. I'm on a call from Automated Creative's new office. And so if this podcast sounds a bit different to normal, it's because I'm in a completely different room with a completely different mic setup. But if you can bear with me for 1 week, normal service will resume. But anyway, it's not about me. It's about Gareth Turner, head of marketing at Weetabix. Gareth, for anyone who doesn't know who you are and what you do, could you give the audience a bit of an overview?
Yeah, thanks. I'm Gareth. I'm head of marketing at Weetabix, as you've said there. I run the Weetabix brand team at Weetabix, and along with the customer services team and the insights team report into my little part of the world. Before that, I was at Arla Foods for 7 years or so, where I was, amongst other things, head of the Arla brand in Europe. And I was the interim marketing director for a while for butter. So things like Lurpak and Adanka were part of my remit. Then before that, I was at Heineken, where I did a range of marketing roles and sales roles. I was a sales director before I saw the light and moved into marketing.
Fantastic. Right. So first off, are you a reader of marketing books, or do you shun them?
I'm a flicker. I think I'm a browser.
Flicker. A browser.
A browser of marketing books. I'm definitely not a shunner, and I wouldn't go as far as saying I'm a reader. I do have, if you can see to my right here, Tom, I've got a little, I call it a mini, maybe overstating it slightly, I have a mini inspiration library to my right. I've got books like The Choice Factory and Building Distinctive Brand Assets and Eat Your Greens, etc. And Go Luck Yourself by Andy Mann. That's a good one. But my go-to book, says, looking through it right now, is How Not to Plan by Les Burnett and Sarah Carter.
So for anyone who hasn't read that book, could you summarize it? What are the main points? What's stuck with you and why would you recommend it to someone else?
It's just a brilliant set of digestible chapters. That each chapter is, a couple of pages long. There's 80-odd, I think, chapters in the book. It's just a series of case studies, like two-page case studies of stuff that's instantly relevant, instantly usable. It's full of real-life examples, full of data-filled case studies. It's got tangible things you can do to implement in your day job. So when I first started reading, I was on a flight to Denmark and I was working at Arla, and I sort of opened the book. I started reading the first chapter, and I think I'd written down like 3 or 4 things I could be doing in my day job that week within half a dozen pages or so. So it's a super useful book about everything to do with marketing.
So can you give me some examples of those case studies? Could you sort of flick through and find one that has really resonated with you and give us a sense of a couple of those things that are worth listening to?
It's all sort of centered around how to do stuff, but framed in the way of how not to do stuff. So it's how not to plan, obviously. So I don't know, I'm randomly opening one here, page 168, your buyers are not my buyers, and not is crossed out. Right? You see what I've done there. It's the same format of each of the chapters. is basically here, this chapter is talking about the theory from how brands grow, that there's everyone has a portfolio of brands, and that you are just temporarily renting your buyers, your consumers off other brands. Everyone has a portfolio, a range of products that they're choosing, and going from a zero to one is the way that you get your brand penetration up, and that's how you'll grow. So what's living here?
Okay, nice. And you jump across to another one.
Let's find another one here. Numbers do not lie. Not to be crossed out there. See what I did there.
Okay.
So there it says here, what's the little blurb here? It says, a simple fact from the numerate people who predominate in advertising research never seem to grasp is that numbers to the innumerates are seen as infallible. I'm sure where they're going in this. But this, what's this chapter telling me? About how to assess numbers. Don't be bamboozled by numbers. Just because there's a number attached to it, it doesn't mean it's valid or relevant. Don't take research numbers at face value. Ask how these numbers were made. Find out exactly what questions were asked and of whom, in what context. So it gives you some checklists of things that you can fall back on when you're thinking about the numbers and how some research data is being presented to you.
Well, that was a lovely testimonial for how not to plan. Thanks for that. So my next planned question, as always, is what is your top marketing tip? You've given me two already. So what is the top marketing tip that you give your team or people you meet on podcasts or wherever else? And what is that silver bullet bit of advice that you always fall back on?
I got loads. So there's stuff about singularity of message, just being able a simple, single-minded message, stuff around separating creative ideas from execution.
You can't just gloss over them. Singularity of message.
No, I'm going, the biggest thing for me is, it's super clunky, right? But the biggest thing for me is that there are four P's of marketing. Execution, right? And that when you are thinking about your plan, go right back to basics. Just think about, have I covered the four P's in my marketing plan? I use that all the time still. When I'm looking at our brand plans for the year ahead, I'm thinking, have we touched those four P's? Have I got enough in each of those buckets? Am I doing enough on price? Have I thought about price? Have I thought about how I'm going to unlock promotional space in store? Have I thought about all the parts of the mix to make my brand plan as compelling as it can be? So the best marketing tip I can give anyone in my team or anyone else's team is go back to the theory, go back to the basics, and just think, have I covered everything in my plan? To have a considered full 360 strategic approach to my plan, rather than being caught up in what the TikTok video is going to be. It needs to be bigger than that. You need to have a even more rounded, thorough plan than that.
This episode of the Shiny New Object podcast is brought to you in partnership with Manfest. Whether it's live in London or streamed online to the global marketing community, you can always expect a distinctive and daring blend of fast-paced content, startup innovation pitches, and unconventional entertainment from Madfest events. You'll find me causing trouble on stage, recording live versions of this podcast, and sharing a beer with the nicest and most influential people in marketing. Check it out at www.madfestlondon.com.
So we are loosely at the halfway stage now. So we're going to talk about your shiny new object, which is one we've never had before. And it's honesty in client agency relationships. So why have you chosen that as your shiny new object? And tell me why you think it's the future of this industry.
Yeah, I know it's a bit of a stretch, right? To call it a shiny new object, because it should be pretty fundamental to human behavior, right? But there are two things that have come together at the same time to really bring this into focus for me. The first thing is some research that I've done. It's something that's interested me, the client-agency relationships. I wanted to find out about when it goes wrong, why is it going wrong, and how can clients and agencies work together to improve that? So I did some research, and things that came out as reasons for poor relationships were that there was a lack of respect from the client, there was a lack of trust from the client, that the client wasn't honest in the relationship, that they weren't honest with timelines. A third of agencies are saying that the timelines were unrealistic and borderline dishonest. So that's thing one that I pulled together. And then there was this piece of work from the Better Briefs project that came out recently about the importance of briefs and how important that is to getting great work. But the stat that stuck out to me was that 80% of clients think they've written a great brief, and 10% of agencies would agree with that. How's that a thing? How have we got to a place where there's that sort of disconnect between what agencies believe is a good brief and what clients believe is a good brief? So it's not just about whether clients are honest with their agency partners. I think there's an honesty both ways. There's a human respect. There's a decency that's required from an agency as well to tell the client, I'm sorry, that brief isn't good enough. You haven't put the budget in there. You haven't been single-minded in the way you've written your benefit or what you're asking to communicate. So there's a mutual respect, mutual honesty that will get us to better work, a more sustainable, happier relationship between the two sides. You see, I'm aware my voice has got a bit more agitated. You see, I'm getting quite passionate about that.
So why has this situation come around? Why do clients ping off emails going, yeah, brilliant brief, and then the agency are going, OMG, this is not a brief. This doesn't make any sense. So why has that happened? Why are we in this situation?
Great question. I'm not sure. I think there has to be something perhaps around an imbalance of power in that. Ultimately, the client is paying money to the agency. And so is there a reluctance to challenge the client when they've got stuff wrong? And the reality is on that research I did, that I asked a flip question about when relationships are going well, what's the number one thing? What's the thing that's making those relationships good? And a quarter of clients say that the most positive relationships are driven by challenge from the agency. So some clients, a lot of clients, are asking for that challenge. I think there's also some behavior from clients which potentially is that they perhaps don't want to be challenged. They don't want to be, they perhaps feel insecure. There's pressures that they're feeling, perhaps. There's that are getting passed on to their agency partners, that there's a short-termism perhaps that's creeping into some of the things that we do. You look at a lot of the awards. The awards, the big awards are often won by brands that have long-term, well-established, effective relationships between brand and agency. So there has to be a relationship between effective work and long-term relationships. And those relationships, I'm sure, would have had some sticky periods over time. So how did those brands get through that? How did they navigate through those choppy waters to come out the other side and still be delivering effective work?
And how much of it do you think is down to budget?
In terms of not having enough budget, or what do you mean by budget?
Well, I mean, for argument's sake, when I was in agency land, if Red Bull showed up with a 30 grand budget and said, right, we want to respond to this tomorrow, you do it, right? And you sort of, you throw it, and there we'd be late night pizzas and coffee and beer trying to work. And we'd be like, what is this briefing? What's it all about? Whereas if it was like, oh, well, we're going to do a five-way pitch and we're going to appoint the agency in 3 months' time and it's going to be worth 3 million quid or whatever, then then you get a very sort of different response. And so actually I'll rephrase the question. Is budget and time what is killing briefs? Because if you're short of both of those things, then it definitely makes it harder to do a great response on a variety of different levels for the agency.
Yeah, quite possibly. I've been fortunate enough to work on well-funded brands for the majority of my career. So there are smaller briefs that come in that we issue, which are lower budget. But I don't think there's any there's no excuse for not being clear about that up front. There's no excuse for being disrespectful with time. I would hate to think that any agency, I'd hate to think that any agency is working overnight on my behalf, or my request. My agency, feel free to call Tom and let them know if that's true or not. But I hope that I've created an environment where, in that example you gave, when Red Bull come with a 30-grand pitch and say I need it overnight, I would expect my agencies to say no. And I would want them to say no if it's not reasonable. And I hope I wouldn't ask for that in the first place. And I was a made-up example, right? But I would expect my agencies to say, well, no, we can't do that. And because we've got home lives, we've got families and friends we want to see as well. So I genuinely don't have a problem with that.
So was there any sense in your research about the difference between a brief in a new business sense or a brief in an existing relationship sense? Because I think the situation I pulled up was very much a new business one. Whereas if you've got like an ongoing client over many years, many markets, many projects, did you get any sense that there was a difference in the accuracy of the brief in those two different scenarios?
That sounds like that would have been a good question to ask, but I didn't ask that, Tom. So thanks for the build. But no, I didn't ask that. It would be interesting to know. Maybe that's a follow-up research
for me. So, not that I've done any research, but my experience of I was a new biz guy for most of my career, actually. And obviously, I still do a bit of that at Automated Creative. And I saw, like, especially at We Are Social, I saw just week after week after week, brief after brief, coming to me first, pretty much, for new business pitches. And I got to the point where these things were often so bad that I just thought, I'm never going to put my own business in a position to have to respond to something like that. So what we do, being quite candid here on the podcast, is we do a thing called a collaborative brief. So if we were going to work together, we'd have a conversation about what it is you're trying to achieve sort of strategically, what was going on with the project. And then I would just take notes, either automate that or a combination of written notes. And then I would write a brief in a Google Doc and send it back to you and go, is this the brief? Have I got this right? And then you as the client would go, oh, actually, no, Tom, you totally missed the point there. And then you just change it in the doc, or I've put TBC. You can drop in, timings, budgets, contacts, whatever, so that we collaborate on the brief to begin with. So from day one, I'm not translating a potentially poorly written brief.
Yeah.
I've showed that I've listened, and I've showed that I can articulate what I've heard back to you. So on day one, but even before we start work, we are partnering. And that was my solution to the problem of receiving bad briefs. And that has worked for, 4 years to, greater or lesser extent. Depends how you value us as a business, but that's our solution to it. Have you seen any other innovative solutions to briefing?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. The old school now, the piece of paper, the email, whatever it is nowadays, should be a summation of weeks, days of collaboration between clients and all agencies. If you're writing a media agnostic, a broad general brief, then a workshop with all your agencies, media agency, creative agencies, digital agencies, whoever you aren't used is what it should be. So that's the very least it should be. It shouldn't just be a ta-da, here's an email, incoming email of a brief that I've trotted out as a client in 5 minutes. That's rubbish. That's not respectful. It's not, and you're not going to get great work. The best So the best brief needs to be collaborative, and they need to be inspirational. I still, what the best, the best brief that I wasn't personally involved in, but I was close to, was when I was at Heineken, and the Foster's team, when they appointed Adam and Eve to the Foster's business, they ran a pitch in a pub. They briefed in the pub. It was a pitch process that perhaps hadn't been quite as collaborative with the agencies for fairly valid reasons, but they immersed the agencies in the world of the on-trade. They had them pouring pints. They presented stuff in the pub. They got them involved. It was a fun, exciting brief, and by inspiring people and working collaboratively wherever possible, you get the best out of people. You get the best people in the agency wanting to work on your piece of business because you're doing things properly, you're fun and inspiring and engaging.
And so going back to the honesty point, how, if someone's listening to this podcast and they're an agency or a brand and they're inspired by your view and your research, what is the immediate step that you can take to make things better?
Take some ownership, I think. So if you're a client, if you're a brand owner, I think we should be creating safe spaces. I think the relationship between an agency and a client, the agency should be an extension of the brand team. So if a member of your team was saying that you didn't feel there was trust or there was respect, or you weren't being honest, or you're being unrealistic, then that you'd have a big problem with that. So why is it okay to have that situation with agency? So create a safe space for your agency to be an extension of your brand's team, to support, to make it okay to challenge, to make challenge seem less challenging. If that makes sense. To make it. Encourage it to make it okay for people to challenge you without getting defensive. To have at Weetabix, we have a phrase which we call autopsy without blame. It's a similar thing to sort of black box thinking that Matthew Sayer talks about in his book. This idea that it's okay for stuff to go wrong. It's okay for us to make mistakes as long as we all learn from it. No one's going to get hung out to dry for that. That's a safe environment, right? And that's not actually the environment clients are creating. That's what clients can do tomorrow, now. Agencies can take a deep breath and challenge. Things won't change unless people take a deep breath and challenge things, challenge stuff that isn't acceptable, to think, well, what's the worst that can happen here? If clients are asking for challenge in their most positive, productive relationships, then challenge. I certainly, you know, within reason, this certainly could come back to haunt me. I certainly respect an agency that says no to me. So unless someone says no, I don't know where the boundary is. So I'll keep pushing until people say, no, that's not reasonable, Darren. That's totally fine for someone to say that to me.
And that is a lovely place to leave it. Gareth, if someone wants to get in touch with you to talk about honesty, to talk about your marketing books or anything else you've mentioned on this podcast, how would you like them to get in touch with you?
Well, the best place is on LinkedIn. I think I'm on LinkedIn probably too much, and just I enjoy it there, looking at what's going on. But if you're going to link in with me, Have some respect for me. Don't try and sell to me at the first thing. The amount of times I get someone connect with me, I go, oh, this sounds interesting. I connect, and then within some automated like selling thing comes in within 5 seconds. I connect straight away. That's not a good look. So I'm more than happy to engage with anyone on LinkedIn, but please don't sell to me straight away.
Gareth, thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
Hi, just before you go, I'd really appreciate it if you could take the time to write a review of the Shiny New Object podcast on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whatever it's called these days, or whichever podcast provider you use. We're an indie podcast, so it would go a long way for us if you could just share the word and give us a bit of a support on those channels. That'd just be fantastic. If you haven't got time, that's also cool. And yeah, if you could tell your colleagues about the podcast, and also, if possible, don't forget to subscribe. And I'd love to hear your feedback. If you'd like to speak on the podcast or be a guest, or you think I'm asking the wrong questions, anything, I'd be super interested to hear what you think. So please email me at tom@automatedcreative.net. That's T-O-M at, I'm not going to bother spelling it. Anyway, you'll work it out. Thanks so much.